Dear friends, this morning we baptized baby Lucas, and it has me thinking about the baptismal fonts that I have experienced in my life. The baptismal font in which I baptized the most children, including two of my own, sits in a Presbyterian church in Geneva, Illinois. It is enormous. The font bowl is made of a heavy patinaed bronze, and it's about 3 feet across. And it's set in an enormous solid wood stand that adds another foot or two to its width. I wondered this week as I was working on this sermon if I was misremembering the size. And so I actually sent an email to one of my former colleagues at that church, and I said, "How big is it? Is it really 3 feet across?" And she went in and measured it for me and said, "You're remembering correctly. It is actually that big in real life." You can fit an entire baby in this font. Not that I ever tried that. But this font is so big that my oldest daughter, when she started to talk, referred to it as the church bath. And one time when I was teaching the pre-baptism class at this church, it suddenly hit me. This baptism thing is scary. Because here was the plan. These parents would hand off their baby to me. And let's be honest, they didn't really know me that well. And then I was going to have to lean well over that font, holding their baby in one arm, and I was going to splash that baby 3 times in the name of the Trinity. And I am a splasher, not a dripper, when it comes to baptism. The more water, I figure, the better. Now, I don't know about the rest of you who have parented children, but I do know that under other circumstances, I would not normally hand my baby off to someone who is sort of a stranger and allow her to dangle this precious child over a 3-foot-wide basin of water. Bathing is one of the easier metaphors for baptism, and it's easy to see it as bathing when we sprinkle or splash water on babies. And so my daughter had it right. It's the church bath. But on the other hand, baptism is not entirely safe. One of the other metaphors for baptism is death and new life. And in baptism, we join in the journey that Jesus took from death to new life. It's easiest to see that metaphor in baptism when a baptism is done by immersion, when the one who is being baptized is taken down into the water and then brought back out. Now, incidentally, there is no theological problem for Lutherans or Presbyterians, for that matter, with baptism by immersion. But since in our traditions we often baptize infants and children more frequently than adults, our sanctuaries are usually set up for the baptism of someone smaller, someone who we wouldn't want to dunk under the water, and so that's what we're more familiar with. Adults and older children who are being baptized can also be baptized at a font, and so that's the more common practice, just for practical reasons. Water has this paradoxical danger. Water is deadly, but it is also necessary for life. Have you ever heard this idea that human beings go to the ocean shore because it reminds us of life? There's this rhythmic pounding of salty waves, like a heartbeat, like the blood coursing through our veins. And what's that number that something like 90% of our bodies are made of water? Psalm 96 says, "Sing to the Lord a new song. Let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar." And maybe going to the water's edge is even a way of participating in that new song to the Lord. Water is life. Too little of it and we die. But in an instant, too much water can also be death. Water is one of those places where we have to give up control. We cannot control the riptides or the downpours, and neither can we control the weather, though sadly we might influence it for the worse with our pollution and our poor care for creation. The people of the Hebrew Scriptures lived in a climate like ours, tucked up against an ocean with wet and dry seasons and droughts. And a drought is the setting of this story from 1 Kings. Israel has been dry for 3 years, and the king Ahab and his queen Jezebel were pushing Israel to follow Baal, a neighboring god who was worshipped for the ability to control things like water and lightning and the seasonal rains. And some people in Israel, in the midst of this drought, were essentially hedging their bets. Well, they seemed to think, if our God Yahweh isn't going to do anything, maybe we should trust Baal. I mean, it is a drought. We'll try anything to end it, won't we? Elijah calls them all out, which God is real. The prophets of Baal get a chance to convince their God, the one who controls lightning, remember, to light up an altar. And after hours of begging, nothing happens. And then Elijah builds an altar and does everything possible to make it impossible to light. He douses it with water, in fact, three times, which sounds an awful lot like a baptism. But Elijah's God, Yahweh, actually does control water and lightning and drought. The altar is consumed by fire and the clouds rise up over the ocean and the rains begin. Elijah knows and has full confidence. God is in control. Baal is not even a thing. And Elijah comes at that knowledge with breathtaking confidence, with a clear sense of purpose and mission. I am frankly in awe of him for this amount of confidence. And then there's also this story we have from Luke today. There's this centurion who we meet. And we have a few clues about his religious inclinations. He's Roman, but he seems to have respect for the Jewish community. He is, by our modern standards, problematic and imperfect, a slave owner, a member of a repressive military regime. He is at the same time confident that Jesus can heal his slave, but reluctant to meet him face to face. He is unsure if he deserves God's favor. He is a confusing character. But one thing sticks out. Jesus says, this man has great faith. Somehow, this centurion has figured out that Jesus, among all of the other religious options available to him, and in spite of all of the privileges and safety nets that he has as a high-ranking member of his society, somehow he has faith that Jesus is the one who can hold back the chaos of sin and death. In our fear, in our worry and anxiety, we can get distracted and we can put our hope in something that will not ultimately save us. Now, most of us are not erecting an altar to Baal in our backyards in hopes that the drought will end, but perhaps we become convinced that we can be saved by our bank accounts or our educational degrees or our social status. We will make it safely through because we exercise and eat right and raise perfect children. Or if we don't feel secure yet, maybe we have that one thing that we can achieve that we're sure would make our life more secure, a relationship, a house, the perfect car. And those things become our idols, not because they are inherently bad. Some of those things have the potential to do great good. It's not that those things are bad, but it is that they do not have the power to hold us safe and secure. Life is scary. Anne Lamott, who you may all be sick of me quoting by now, wrote this about her son Sam after he was born. Sam is unbelievably pretty, with long, thin, Christ-like feet. I told my friend Carpenter this, and he said, "It's an often difficult world out there, and it's good to have long, grippy feet." Psalm 96 reminds us God's world is firmly established. It shall never be moved. And there are days when it is difficult to believe that our grippy toes are going to hold on, that the world is in fact firmly established, that we will not be overcome by chaos. There are days when it feels like everything is spinning out of our control. But here's the truth. Whether we come to life with a clear plan like Elijah, or whether, like the centurion, the best we can do is to send our friends and neighbors, and we're not even sure that we deserve what God has to offer. God is the one who is in control. This world belongs to God. The oceans and the heavens sit firmly in God's hand. It all belongs to God, and so do we all. God will bring us through. God will draw us out. God will call us by name and invite us to service. God's hand is holding us fast. This is love, that God is present for us whether we come with the full confidence of Elijah or the impartial understanding of that centurion. God is present whether we come to the waters walking on our own 2 feet or carried like a babe in arms. God made this world. It is firmly established. Let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar its praises. We will not fall into the waters. Thanks be to God.